I remember the cameras turning for the first shot of my first picture. The actors were all in their places, and they were looking at me expectantly. I had no idea what was required. Finally, my assistant, the splendid Jack Sullivan, whispered to me, "Say action."
That's screenwriter-director John Huston at the AFI Lifetime Achievement Awards. The movie he is talking about is The Maltese Falcon. Welcome to Word by Word, the Conversations with Writers show on KRCB 91.1 FM or streaming online at krcb.org. I am your host, Gil Manser, and tonight's guest is the prolific biographer, Jeffrey Myers, author of John Huston, Courage and Art. Jeffrey Myers grew up in New York, was an undergraduate at Michigan, and earned his doctorate at Berkeley. He taught in Japan, at UCLA, and Tufts University before teaching at the University of Colorado from 1975 to 1992. One of the most respected scholars in his field, he has published 47 books and 675 articles on modern American, English, and European literature, and is one of only 12 Americans who are fellows in the Royal Society of Literature. His well-known biographies include Hemingway, D.H. Lawrence, Gary Cooper, American Hero, Bogart, A Life in Hollywood, and The Genius and the Goddess, Arthur Miller and Marilyn Monroe. His newest book is John Huston, Courage and Art, and we are pleased to welcome Jeffrey Myers to Word by Word. I've got to confess that I was curious to meet you in person because of the painting that you have. We've talked about this a little bit off air now, but there's a painting of you on the book jacket of a man with a walrus mustache wearing a white jacket, bow tie, and fez. Do you want to tell us a little bit about where this came from and what it represents?
I use the portrait, which I commissioned from a young Scottish painter called Kevin Cunningham in London. And I wanted to, I own the painting, and I wanted to have a picture in the book that's different than the usual, rather solemn and maybe pompous author's ponderous photo. So Kevin painted me as Sidney Greenstreet in Casablanca with a fez, and in the back, Humphrey Bogart, Dooley Wilson, the pianist, and Sasha, the Russian waiter who escorts Bogart's girlfriends home at night when they're half drunk. And I also commissioned another portrait from Kevin of an English novelist friend, a very close friend of mine called Francis King. And I have that in my study, so I feel close to Francis and inspired when I'm doing my work. So that's how that came about.
Well, you don't really look like Sidney Greenstreet. Not the 380-pound one we remember from the Maltese
Falcon. I'm holding in my stomach as I speak to you.
You begin the book in a very interesting way, almost as if it's an essay by itself, and it's the comparison between Hemingway and Huston. So how did this come about? Why did you start there?
Well, it partly came about because of why I became interested in Huston, and Hemingway was one big reason. I'd written three books on Hemingway, including a biography in 1985. And when I started studying Huston, all these resemblances jumped up very clearly. Huston was a friend, not a close friend, but certainly a tremendous admirer of Hemingway.
Well, he called himself a close friend on more than one occasion.
I wouldn't say that. They didn't meet very often. They were just
letters. No, I know, but I'm saying Huston, when he was talking about the relationship, would give it a higher amount of
time
together.
Well, that's what people usually say when they knew Hemingway. We were muy amigo, but in fact,
right,
they were somewhat distant. And one of Huston's ambitions was to make a Hemingway film, mm-hmm. and he never managed to do that. Hemingway was pretty disappointed with almost all the films, except maybe The Killers.
Yes.
And most of Hemingway's films aren't very good. There is this sort of general rule that the better the novel, the worse the film, and that the best films come out of good novels but not great ones. The novel of War and Peace, for example, is a complete bore.
Right.
And I think the novel of Dr. Zhivago is actually better than the film of Dr. Zhivago is actually better than the novel. So I thought this would be a good way to open the book, not just, you know, Huston was born in,
mm-hmm.
but more important, it opened up all the themes of the novel. That is, everything that I wanted to pursue, everything I wanted to pursue throughout the biography was stated in that opening chapter.
It's almost like a summary, if you will, of the two people's parallels and how they had similar passions and foibles.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think anybody ever said that before. And I should say, I don't really have much time for editors of my books. And the great editorial contribution was to cut out the first chapter.
Really?
Which I of course, rejected.
So you put it back in?
No, I never took it out. I mean, that was his useless suggestion. And I've had so far about 6 reviews before the book has come out. And I think 4 or 5 of them said what a good opening it was of the book. So, I mean, if you're a beginning author, then you tend to cave in to the editorial suggestions. But if you've written a lot of books over a lot of years, then the editor's opinion really doesn't count for much. My wife is a superb editor. She edits everything I write before I send it in. And when I send it in, it's ready to go. It doesn't need any more editing after she's edited it.
Well, you started out by mentioning one of the difficulties that a biographer has is that there's this triteness, I guess you will, this ease of starting with so-and-so was born at so-and-such and such a place, and then you end up with their, you know, their death and eulogy. And I've talked to several biographers, and I've said this, you know, it doesn't have to be the way it's done. And so I was kind of delighted that you didn't do that.
Well, there are ways around it. A lot of people start off with a spectacular death of the person they're writing about.
Right.
I think somebody who did that well was Jeffrey Wolfe in his biography of Harry Crosby. But, of course, you could have done that in the Hemingway book, too. But I didn't do it that way because I thought that was a climax rather than the beginning. And also everybody knew that Hemingway had killed himself. And so
let me ask you a question. When you're doing a novel, we have what's called the story arc, which, you know, standard up, build up to a certain point and then go down and then build up again and then finally come up to the huge climax and off with a denouement, as it's called. Do you consciously do that with people's lives and try to fit them into that kind of mold or what?
I don't. Maybe some people do. That sounds to me like what you learn in a writing course in college, which I was a college teacher for 30 years and I'm very skeptical about how much you can learn in a writing course. And that sounds very mechanical. What I'd like to do is to have some kind of climax at the end of every chapter, which then in some way that you indicate leads into the next chapter and the next part of the story. The most deadly way of starting a biography is with genealogy, which anybody who spends more than a page on that is really going to start losing his readers. So I think it's very important to get your man born right away, but not in the first sentence.
Right.
So you have to think of some kind of startling and thematic opening as opposed to the violent death of your subject. And this was my solution to it in this book, and I felt it worked well.
Well, it's important, though, I think, that we met his parents and a little bit about his grandparents, because certainly his early upbringing shaped him for what he was going to be, especially this one diagnosis you described. You want to tell our listeners about that?
Yeah, well, Houston makes a lot of this in his autobiography, and I thought it was important. I took it as a kind of paradigmatic incident in his life. He's declared when he was a boy, around an adolescent, he's declared an invalid, that he has an enlarged heart, that he can't exercise, that he really has to be confined to a hospital bed for 2 years and not even fed a normal amount of food that a growing boy would need. And one day he grasps reality and says, I can't go on like this. And he leaves. This is according to his story. There's no corroboration. But even if it didn't happen, it's still si non è vero e buon trovato. You know, if it didn't really happen, it's still a good story.
Right.
As he made it. So he goes to swim in this mill pond and gets caught in a waterfall and survives. And then he figures, I'm okay. I'm not sick anymore. I'm not an invalid. And I want to be a man and I want to take risks. And this is where the courage part of it comes in. The courage theme, which is not just idle in the subtitle, but in fact runs through the book. And I think he was a brave man, and he did take risks, and he did do wild and crazy things. And I think maybe the most courageous thing he ever did, apart from marrying 5 times, was at the end of his life, when he was making his last couple of films, he was in a wheelchair, and he was attached to an oxygen tank.
Right.
And he had emphysema. Again, you could say it's courageous or risky or crazy, but even when he had emphysema, he didn't stop smoking.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he switched from cigarettes to cigars as a mild concession. So imagine, and we see pictures of him. There's a wonderful documentary of the making of The Dead, which was his last film, based on Joyce's story. The title's a little unfortunate because it suggests a moviegoer is a horror movie, or somebody coming back from the dead a la Edgar Allan Poe. But in fact, it's Joyce's greatest story in Dubliners, and it's certainly one of Huston's greatest films. And it provides, if you're looking for a finale to a book, that's a great finale. It's a masterpiece. It's perfect. I've seen it over and over and over again, and every time I see it, I like it just as much. And this documentary, which I would recommend, I can't think of something like James Joyce and the Dubliners Making of the Dead, something like that. It's in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So that's his grasping his own life when he's still a kid and saying, I'm not going to live the way the doctors tell me to live. I'm going to live the way I want to live. I'm going to do what I want to do. He's always done that all the way through life. He's a really wild, reckless guy. And you can see that all the way through the book. He's my kind of guy. He's a Hemingway kind of guy, and I admire him tremendously, although I'm certainly aware of his faults. I'm not trying to pull him down, but I'm giving both sides of it. The other day, I got a very gratifying letter from his fifth wife, Cece, Celeste Huston, who gave me a lot of help and gave me very valuable all the letters that she and John wrote to each other. And she's had a very bad press in previous books because John knocked her very strongly, called her the crocodile. I mean, he was very, very wounded when she left him, the only wife who ever left him out of five. And so I went to see her. She has a horse ranch near Santa Barbara. And she's great fun. She's very open, a little vulgar and crude, but in a sort of nice way, sexy. She's almost, I think she's exactly my age. And we had fun that afternoon, and she gave me a lot of help. And she sent me a letter yesterday or 2 days ago saying, wow, you know, I just loved what you wrote about me. I don't know if she'll ever read the rest of the book, but she certainly read that chapter. And the one thing that was really funny, she said to—
You have a nice photograph of her in here, too.
She's a good-looking girl.
Yes.
She said to Zoe Salas, another one of John's girlfriends—
And mother of Danny Huston.
Yeah, mother of Danny Huston. John said to Zoe, she has sexual tricks. Evidently, they really had a great sex life. So we had a couple of drinks, and Cece was, you know, we were laughing and fooling around. And I said, well, what are those sexual tricks anyway? What did you actually do? And she said, trade secrets.
Uh-huh.
That was the one thing she wouldn't answer. Uh-huh. But she was a lot of fun. So I tried
But it makes it piques your interest even more because she didn't, right?
You figure it out for yourself.
That's right.
So I wanted to show the other side of Cece that if you had the documentary evidence of the letters, there's no doubt that John was deeply in love with her and deeply wounded when she left him. And she tried to be a good wife, and he was wildly unfaithful. Maybe she was naive to think that he would remain faithful.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't. There's some very, very funny stories, I think, that she told me involving John. She's in – can I just tell one? She's in the hot tub with a number of her girlfriends, all young, very good-looking, very sexy. Naked, I should think, in the hot tub because, you know, John walks into the room – with pajamas with a lot of cigarette burn holes in them. And I forget when she's not looking. Somehow he puts this thing in the tub. He distracts her and puts this thing in the tub. And they're all sitting around laughing. And suddenly look at this thing. And it's a floating turd in the hot tub with these four sexy, beautiful women. And it just kind of floats and floats and floats toward them. And Cece tries to grab it and get. Of course, it's made out of plastic or something like that. You used to buy that thing in a joke store when you were a child.
Plastic vomit and stuff like that. Yeah.
But it's a very good story the way she tells it, and it is quite funny. And everybody was absolutely horrified because they knew that that's the sort of thing that John just might do to throw everybody, you know, into a kind of panic.
Well, there was a crudeness to his what do we call them, jokes or. I don't know. There's something that almost when he felt that he wasn't in control, he'd do that to get the control back.
Yeah. Well, that was a joke. Sometimes he could be cruel as well as crude, more often cruel than crude.
He was to many of his actors.
Yeah. But, you know, he is a director. The director's God. And he was a very, very good director, and he always knew what he was doing.
He was God, even when he didn't seem to know
what he was doing. For example, Katharine Hepburn says in her book on the African Queen, They're doing a scene, and John is standing on this raft in some African river fishing with his back to Katharine Hepburn. And she says, John, you know, what do you think? How am I doing? You're fine, doing fine. He was listening to her. He wasn't watching her. He was listening.
Mm-hmm.
He knew what he was doing. He was in control. He wanted to hear how she sounded. And he had faith that she could act in the way that she wanted to and that he would be pleased with. So that part of his pose, you know, this I use the word sprezzatura. It's a word from Castiglione's the courtier in the Renaissance. And sprezzatura means somebody who achieves everything with apparent effortlessness. You know, there's just no trying to do anything. You just master it.
Right.
And impress people about how good you are at everything you try to do.
Well, there's a couple of things, actually. His first real movie where he directed was The Maltese Falcon. And you talked about a good book and a good movie, and that I think that's a good book by itself and a great movie.
Well, let's talk about The Maltese Falcon because it's very important for Huston, his first film that he directed. He had written a number of screenplays before. He also wrote the screenplay. Mm-hmm. It was also his first movie with Bogart.
And he has a little cameo in it, as I recall, too.
Well, his father.
Ah.
His father. There's a scene when Captain Jacoby of the Paloma, is the burning ship
right.
that brought the Maltese Falcon to America, and Captain Jacoby is shot by people trying to get the Falcon. So he carries the Falcon wrapped in newspaper into Sam Spade's, into Bogart's office, at which point he collapses mm-hmm. on the floor, dead.
And that's Walter Huston.
That's Walter Huston, a very famous actor in his time, and just kind of helping John out in his first movie, giving him a little paternal support. John went on after that movie to be Bogart's closest friend. He gave a brilliant eulogy when Bogart died.
Bogart was within, what, five movies?
Yeah, I think he was in five more. He was in Across the Pacific, a minor movie.
Right.
But he was in The African Queen. He was in The Treasure of the Sierra Madre. He was in Beat the Devil.
Right.
And
that's a good memory. That's
whatever.
Cool. Yeah.
There's others.
Yeah.
There were five more, I think. When you see the film, you're struck by the tremendously fast pace of it. It really zips along and keeps your interest all the time. It takes place in San Francisco, so that's kind of fun because it opens up with an establishing shot of the Bay Bridge in the background, and they mention Bush Street and Burlingame and other specific places in San Francisco and the Bay Area.
That famous shot through the window with Spade and Archer on the glass.
Yeah, and then when Archer's killed, he calls somebody in and he says, take his name
off
the window.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he finds it fun to have an affair with Archer's wife when Archer's alive. But when Archer's dead, he dumps Iva. And though he's involved with three different women. I mean, Effie, his secretary, adores
right.
him.
Right.
Iva,
Archer. Remember,
of course,
that we're in the middle of the censorship era in 1940s in that you can't talk about certain things, and you mention in here the things in the book which were downplayed completely or taken out of the screen.
Although Huston and all the directors of that time were ingenious in finding their way around the restrictions of the production code, and the best example in The Maltese Falcon is Peter Lorre. Homosexuality, of course, is absolutely forbidden in American movies. So how do you suggest that Peter Lorre is a homosexual without actually saying or doing anything? Well, first of all, Effie comes into the office and said, there's this man here who smells of gardenias. And then Peter Lorre comes in and he has a Levantine passport and he has this oily, curly hair. And then he speaks, of course, in a very affected, mannered way.
Well, he's wearing weight gloves and carrying a cane,
and what does he do with the cane?
Yeah,
he puts the cane between his lips, and he's kind of sucking at his own ivory-topped cane. And instead of having the usual goons and gangsters and tough guys that are always punching you or hitting you over the head and shooting you with machine guns, you have a group of criminals who are very sophisticated and very well-spoken, beautifully dressed. Sidney Greenstreet is wearing spats and, you know, striped trousers and, you know, a vest and a – and.
I love talking to a man who loves to talk.
Yeah, but yes. that's a great line. I like talking to a man who likes to talk.
Here we are, right.
Greenstreet does all the talking, and Bogart's very laconic. He says things like, you don't say. Yeah, that's right. You know, he never engages in the conversation with Greenstreet.
How about if we listen to a clip from that memorable scene in John Huston's The Maltese Falcon, with Humphrey Bogart as Sam Spade and Sidney Greenstreet as Mr. Gutman?
I tell you right out, I'm a man who likes talking to a man who likes to talk.
Swell. Will we talk about the Blackbird?
You're the man for me, sir. No beating about the bush. Right to the point. Let's talk about the Blackbird, by all means.
Back to your Peter Lorre thing, there's a clue in there, and I didn't know this until I read the book, because I've watched the film. I'm a, you know, show the film in some of my classes. And he's referred to as a gunsel, which I always thought meant, I mean, as, you know, somebody who carried a gun. But you mentioned that it may actually mean gay.
Yeah, that's another. It means little goose in German, ganz, and gunsel. And nobody picks that up when you see the movie. How can you possibly, unless you know German slang?
Right.
But somehow I got onto that. And that's Elisha Cook Jr., who also has a great line. You should remember this in case anybody ever annoys you. He said, "Keep riding me like that and you'll be picking lead out of your liver." And that's really a terrific line. That comes right out of the book.
Yeah.
So what I started to say was, all through his life, Huston made 34 out of 37 feature films based on literary texts.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, he did 3 war documentaries.
You call the Bible a literary text?
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's a written book. And he's, in fact, he's fairly faithful to that, too. He only does something like the first 6 books of, chapters of Genesis.
Yeah, right.
He doesn't really go beyond
the sexy
that.
Bits.
Sexy. And he's in it. He's very good.
Oh, he's Noah.
Very good in the. There's and a picture
he reads,
of him.
And his voiceover is the opening line about the darkness will fall on the face of the.
Well, he
deep,
sent this photographer, this German photographer, Eric somebody, I can't remember his name, out to film these natural, you know, waterfalls and volcanoes and lightning storms. And it works pretty well to suggest the creation of the world, you know, when there was everything was void and blackness. And then, you know, God created all these things out of nothing.
Let's hear Huston's great stentorian voice reading from the first lines of Genesis for his movie, The Bible.
In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void. And darkness was upon the face of the deep.
The backstory of the Bible is far more interesting than the film itself. I think the film doesn't work. But
it doesn't work on a variety of levels. Well, I don't like the opening that you just mentioned. It doesn't come up to Disney standards, I guess.
It's a little ponderous. I mean, what are you going to do? How would you do it better? I mean, it's a very tricky thing to try to—
Fantasia.
I mean, a lot of people might let's just start with, when first things were created, not when the world was dark and void and black and so on. But getting the animals onto the ark was quite an achievement. He even had some cats, you know, some big cats who would eat other animals.
And then he tried to have Adam, the actor who was playing Adam, be friendly with one of the tigers in several scenes.
Well, that's another way, that John teasing people and exercising control and that sort of thing. Michael Parks, in fact, I got in touch with him, and he gave me a very good interview. He's kind of an amusing guy. The actors are hard to get to talk, especially if they're not working anymore and can't get any benefit. And they're very suspicious of writers. And they really can't tell the difference, most of them, between a professor and a PhD who's written serious books and some guy from the National Enquirer.
Right.
They're just very – they've been trashed. You know,
a journalist.
Portrayed as stupid and vulgar and crass and hopeless.
Fact that Michael Parks' scenes in this is there was a lot of nudity, or almost nudity, except for when the fans were turned on and the fig leaves blew away.
Yeah, I mean, he tells me that kind of thing. I mean, he was good. I did write to the girl, the Swedish girl.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember her name. But, you know, she's listed somehow in the Stockholm telephone directory.
Oh.
And she just made this one film and then, you know, went on to do whatever she did. You know, she was studying anthropology at the university in Sweden. But alas, she didn't answer. But if you do get an actor to answer, or actress, then you usually get very good response from them. But it's a lottery. You just try to get everybody you can, and you just get some. You can get the producers, you can get the directors, get the writers, but getting the actors is difficult. I had an absolutely fabulous interview with Susanna York, who was in Freud,
mm-hmm.
and there was tremendous conflict in Freud, maybe the greatest conflict with an actor in his whole career, with Houston and Monty Clift.
Monty Clift, right. Well, part of that was his Houston's – when he discovered, when he accidentally walks into the bedroom and finds Clift in bed with him, another man.
In his own house. Yeah. It happened, and it's a – why should Houston, who's such a – sexual predator, such a man
exactly.
of the world, worldly, you know, so sophisticated, so experienced. Why should he be so shocked that men are in bed together, even granting it was 50 years ago? And also, anybody who knew Monty Clift knew that Monty Clift was homosexual, so that's not exactly a big surprise. So, I mean, it offended his sense of propriety. It wasn't so much that men were having sex or kissing each other, or
yeah,
whatever
they
were doing.
Yeah, but he had this separate house away from his family.
No, but I think this was in the big house.
It wasn't.
Because, you know, he had his wife in the other house.
Wrong.
It was like, you're doing this in my house. You know, this guy, and he sneaked the guy in. I mean, he didn't say, can, you know, Joe stay
my
with
friend
me tonight?
Stay with
yeah,
me.
You know,
right,
he needs a
right.
place to sleep. He kind of he sneaked him in. And so Houston was offended. And Houston admitted, you know, he was homophobic. I mean, he just something about him. He just couldn't deal with this, which wasn't so rare in those days and even exists, of course, today, too, outside of San Francisco. I think it just had to do with social propriety. It's his house. Clift is his guest. He brought somebody in without permission and behaved in an inappropriate way. So it might have been if he got out of bed and pissed in the corner instead of going to the bathroom. I mean, it's that kind of thing.
Right.
But Houston had plenty of other connections to homosexuals in the movie business. He worked with Truman Capote mm-hmm. in Beat the Devil, and he thought Truman Capote – nobody could be more flagrant than him.
Right.
He thought Truman Capote was a very amusing fellow and a very good screenwriter who did great work on Beat the Devil. And that's a famous story, you know, Truman Capote beating Bogart in arm wrestling and at $50 a shot. Not that Bogart was a big, tough guy, but Truman Capote must have been about 5 feet tall or something like that.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
He's hardly a Hercules.
But he had strong arms.
I guess. He was on pretty good terms with Tennessee Williams, and he did The Night of the Iguana. Williams was somewhat involved in that. And I can't think offhand who else, but there were others
as well. You write in here that he was okay with someone if they were flamboyant and out of the closet. The difficulty he had, you know, was with Tony Perkins and Montgomery Clift, who were more, you know, keep it a secret kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't think Perkins was in one or two movies. I don't think that came up. But, yeah, I mean, this idea that maybe he was sort of surprised that he missed it. He said, you know, I'm such a clever fellow. You know, how come I didn't see Monty
right.
Clift?
Right.
Anyway, Susanna York, to go back to her,
yeah.
she died recently, I think this year, fairly young. She was very pro-Monty Clift and very, very anti-Houston. Now, this is a very tricky situation because there's two biographies of Monty Clift, one very good one. And then, you know, you just have to look at all the evidence. There's Susanna York blasting Houston for being cruel. In some ways, Monty Clift was participating in Houston's cruelty. It was a real sadomasochistic thing. Some of the stories I just didn't believe, you know, that he was making him slide down this rope with bare hands and have blood dripping down. I mean, that's non-productive when you're making a movie. I mean, to make one scene is very, very expensive. Houston, you know, was a real pro. He finished on time. He finished under budget. You don't have this guy sliding up and down the rope with bloody hands over and over and over again. I don't believe that.
You are listening to Word by Word, Conversations with Writers on KRCB 91.1 FM, where tonight's guest is Jeffrey Myers, talking about his newest biography, John Houston, Courage and Art. We begin the next half hour with Jeffrey discussing a macho battle between Houston and Ernest Hemingway. So stay tuned to KRCB 91.1 FM or streaming online at krcb.org.
He gets a tough guy like Robert Mitchum, who was tough, and he says, how much can you take? The man, you know, we're having a mano here. You know, let's say, who's more of a man? Who's tougher? Who can take it? Who can do the heat, the swimming? Who can find the prey? Who can follow the sports code? Who can outdo the other?
Right.
You might say psychological and aquatic arm wrestling equivalent. So Hemingway searches around and finds this iguana under the rock, or wherever it was, and pulls it back. And he humiliates Houston. And I did what you should have done. You gave up, and I did it, and I won the trophy, and I'm better than you, and don't mess around.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that kind of thing. But when it came to boxing, Hemingway, of course, was much heavier, and they were about the same size and height, but Hemingway had many pounds over Houston. And Hemingway said, you're not gonna jab me with your long arms, are you? By this time, Hemingway was in his late 50s. He had a heart condition. So Mary Hemingway pulled Houston aside and said, no boxing with Papa. You know, he's not in shape for this kind of thing. So Houston, of course, didn't want to hurt Hemingway in any way.
Right.
So let off. But there is this kind of, you know, masculine combat all the time, whether it's with Hemingway, whether it's with Clift, whether it's with Robert Mitchum, or whenever Houston had the chance. On one hand, he just liked male combat, and on the other hand, he liked asserting his authority. On the other hand, if you have another hand, he liked being cruel.
Mm-hmm. He also had this feeling, sort of the droit de seigneur. If I'm going to have a beautiful woman as the actress in my movie, with most you list some exceptions, they were ripe for the picking.
Well, that's the way it was in Hollywood in those days, and maybe it still is. It's not casting,
yeah, yes.
But it just sort of went with the game. And in this first movie, he had an affair with Mary Astor. I mean, these are very good-looking women. Mary Astor was involved in a tremendous sexual scandal at the mm-hmm. time, love letters that she had written, including rating the qualities of her lovers, 1 to 10 or whatever,
right.
were read in court by her estranged husband who wanted to regain custody of their child. So this and her lover turns out to be George S. Kaufman, you know, this decrepit old guy. You know, he's hardly sexy or attractive in any way. He used to be on television when I was a little boy, some quiz show or something like that. He just sleeps with Mary Astor, and why not? She was quite willing, and he had this long thing with Olivia de Havilland mm-hmm. off and mm-hmm. on for many, many years.
So you have dozens and dozens of pages of notes for every chapter in the back. It's extremely well documented.
Well, let's talk about sources. The main source was the Herrick Library, which is the library of the American Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, which gives the Academy Awards.
Right.
And it's in Beverly Hills. It's a beautiful library.
Setting,
it's a joy to work there.
Been
the
there.
Staff is terrific. It's like a hotel lounge or lobby. You know, it's very comfortable. And the whole thing to do is to get the people, just keep the material coming, just keep it coming. So you don't have to sit there waiting for the next, because you can only look at one envelope at a time, mm-hmm. you know, one box at a time, blah, blah, blah. So, but I they knew what I wanted. They're very helpful. And I said, you know, just keep the stuff rolling. Obviously, you're not going to read every word. You'd be there, you know, for 10 years. You know what you're looking for before you go there. There's certain kinds of things written on pink onion slips, which are the daily reports by the, you might say, the on-site production manager. And it has problems, you know, that they encounter, all kinds of problems, you know, from serious things like Audrey Hepburn being thrown off a horse when she was pregnant and hurting her back, to a woman who can't be on a horse because she's having her period that day, or big fights between people, sometimes physical fights, often verbal fights, or any problem that happens. The lights don't work, equipment doesn't, you know, somebody screws up, there's a car chase scene that doesn't work. That's always interesting on those pink onion skin slips. And things have to do with money are interesting, you know, how much it cost, how much people were paid, how long it took to make the movie. Anyway, working in the Herrick was great. And by chance, on the computer, I managed to find an apartment around the corner so I could walk to work
uh-huh.
in L.A., which meant saving hours a day, not having to drive in the bad traffic. So that was nice. The other source is interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And I list all the people that I interviewed, quite a few of them.
Yeah.
Some of them, you know, I mentioned already, Celeste Houston was very, very good. Susanna York was very good. Jackie Bisset was very good. Guy Gallo, who wrote the screenplay for Under the Volcano when he was a graduate student at Yale. 50 people had failed to write the screenplay, and right. Guy Gallo figured out how to do it. Well, Guy Gallo kept very elaborate journals and diaries of the time that he was working with Houston in Mexico. Why he never published them, I don't know. He never got around to it. In a very generous gesture, he just gave them to me and said, here, use whatever you like. So that was a terrific amount of information on under the volcano.
Well, one of the reasons that I found this so fascinating that you had so much material is how you have this chapter at the end, and it's after Houston has died. And there's the – in fact, maybe you'd want to read it to everybody because it's so fascinating. What happened to his artworks and his can you do that? It's just a little paragraph here.
Yeah, if you show me which one.
Okay, it says start and stop. That work?
Yeah.
Great.
Houston's monetary estate for someone who had earned so much money was relatively small. The rest of his belongings, more valuable to posterity, were squandered. His books, private papers, and personal correspondence, his Oscars and honorary degree, some of his own painting, and all his pre-Columbian statues were in the house at Las Caletas, where he lived with Marisela. They were either burned, destroyed, discarded, lost, buried, stolen, stored, or hidden. And the many explanations for their mysterious disappearance are unconvincing. Jan Lavender, his friend in Puerto Vallarta, blamed the tragic loss on gross neglect and on the termites and tropical storms of the Mexican coast. She said Houston's house was deserted when he died in Rhode Island, and his extensive library moldered away in the primitive huts and encroaching jungle. In her view, his papers would have disintegrated, had been trashed in a matter of weeks. At the end, there wasn't much left. I cite that, but I don't think that's the true.
I had the feeling that you thought there was something else going on. I remember earlier in the book you talked about the dupeness of the pre-Columbian artifacts, which might not have or probably are not pre-Columbian.
A lot of them were fake. He sold a lot to a collector in Texas, and then the collector donated them to a museum in Dallas. And then when the museum started looking into them, they decided that most of that stuff was fake. Then Houston was conned by his own close friend, Billy Pearson, mm-hmm. the former jockey, mm-hmm. who was an expert in smuggling real art from Mexico to America, but also creating fake art. And then even he was duped at once because he said, I was right there at the excavation when they dug it up.
Right.
And I took pictures of it when they took it out of the ground, but somebody had put it into the ground.
Before he got there.
Yeah,
right.
So the mine. The original Mexicans conned and faked out Pearson, and then Pearson conned Houston, and Houston conned the Texas collector, and the Texas collector conned the museum, and then finally it stopped when the museum realized that they were phony and threw them out, and that nobody else was in this whole chain. It's really quite funny when you think of it. All right, Marisela, who was with him at the end in Mexico, mm-hmm. Marisela is the Mexican maid of Ceci Houston,
right.
John's fifth wife.
Right.
So it was a terrible betrayal for John to seduce Ceci's maid.
We just saw it happen or uncovered in recent politics, didn't we?
It happens, but I think part of it was retaliation against Ceci. Also, by all accounts, and there's a picture of her in the book, Marisela is not attractive in any way at all. She appears very briefly in that documentary about the making of the mm-hmm. dead. Mm-hmm. And, she really has nothing going for her. She's tiny. She's uneducated. She's unattractive. She doesn't dress well. She just adores John and is his slave. And when you're a real old guy and you're very sick, that's a nice person to have with you. Also, John was a tremendous conversationalist, and Marisela was known to be very silent and have a poor command of English. So
she was a good listener.
Yeah, of all the people in the world, here's a guy that slept with all these different famous actresses, and he winds up with this Mexican maid who's just nobody and nothing. Anyway, she's disappeared. She's still alive.
Oh, really?
I know the street that she lives on in L.A., but it's a very long street. And I tried to get in touch with her through the lawyer who distributes the benefits of John's estate, which is what she lives on.
Mm-hmm.
He left her a house in
royalties
L.A.
Royalties in the site.
Yeah, whatever comes in. He left her, an apartment in L.A., and he left her that house in Mexico, which I think she sold. And now I see you can take a boat from Puerto Vallarta to that island and have a barbecue and dance and then go home. It's a sort of tourist site now, which if I were down there, I would go look at.
Go and see, sure.
I suspect she's hiding out. One, she's probably just shy. And two, I think she has all kinds of stuff that she doesn't want anybody to know about. I mean, I don't think it just blows away in the wind. an Oscar, you know, is made out of very heavy metal. I've picked up many an Oscar in people's houses when they showed them to me. Mm-hmm. John had two of them. And, you know, they just don't melt in the tropical air. I mean, you'd need
Or even rust because they're gold-plated.
Yeah, I mean, you'd need a machine gun to get rid of an Oscar. I mean, they just don't – they're not like fly paper or something.
But it hasn't appeared on eBay or someplace yet, huh?
No, I mean, so people are sort of hiding. I think she's afraid that if she shows what she has, then the children would make a legal claim against it. Then there's a question of Grobel, who wrote a book on the Houstons, I don't know, 20 years or 30 years ago.
30 years now, yeah.
On the three different generations of Houstons. And he used the stuff from the Herrick, and then he had the papers that John gave him from something like 1980 to 1987. And then he said publicly that, and in print, that he gave it to Tony Houston. Well, Tony Houston never got it. So what Grobel should have done is given it to the Herrick along with all the other papers of John.
Sure.
But instead, he said he gave it to Tony. He didn't give it to Tony. So presumably, Grobel still has the papers, which someday he will.
Or they're in the dead letter office somewhere.
Sell or give.
Yeah.
So, you know, there
are
these mysteries. You hope that when the book is published, people will come forward and say, oh, yeah, you know, you wanted to know about this. And it's happened to me a couple of times. I'll give you one example because I found this very interesting. When I was running a life of Robert Frost, I discovered that Frost was having an affair after his wife died with the wife of a Harvard professor, with the complicity of the Harvard professor who adored Frost, as long as everything remained calm on the surface and no scandal emerged.
Everyone knew what was going on.
No, it wasn't known. That was the thing.
Within that group of three people.
But basically, you know, it was kept secret. Partly for Frost's image. So I got in touch with the daughter of the woman who was Frost's mistress, and I went to see her in Amherst. And when I came into her house, she said, I've been waiting all my life for you to come, meaning I've been waiting all my life to tell the story to someone, but who already knew the story, so I wouldn't have to be the one who told it for the first time.
Right.
And then I said to her, but you were married at the time. What about your husband? I'd like to talk to him. She said, oh, you don't want to see him. You know, he's nothing. He doesn't know anything. I'm divorced from him. Forget him. And I was having a delicate handling with her, and I thought, well, I'll forget about the husband. So I published the book, and I get a letter from her husband in Ohio, ex-husband. And he said, you know, all that time I was married, I think her name was to Anne, the daughter, I used to watch Frost and Kay Morrison, and I used to wonder, something's going on around here, something funny about it, something, and I never understood what was going on until I read your book. And I thought that was really a tremendous compliment, and I was very pleased. Now, one mystery that was left over from the Houston book, his Irish publicist, writing in a very obscure Irish journal, said that Edna O'Brien wrote a story about Houston. Now, Edna O'Brien worked with Houston.
This is the novelist.
The Irish novelist. Yes. Very, very good looking,
yes.
Edna O'Brien.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, needless to say, I didn't say it in the book, but, you know.
Another conquest.
Houston slept with everyone, and they wanted to. So she went down to Mexico to work with him on a screenplay called The Rack, which never was made. So I wrote to her and said, and it was a very bad experience for her. They quarreled, and it was a disaster. She said, I don't want to talk about it. Then I wrote to her again, and I said, just tell me which story you wrote about Houston. She said, she didn't answer that one. So then I wrote to three women in Ireland who had written about Edna O'Brien. I said, which story? And they didn't know. So I decided after the book was over, I had a little more time to look into this tiny but still intriguing point. I found
the story. She's written a story with Houston as a character,
yeah,
unnamed
but
in the story?
Yeah, unnamed, you know,
right.
A character based on Houston.
Right.
So I found the story, and it really was very interesting because it was partly about Edna O'Brien's affair with Houston. But none of those Irish women scholars knew anything about Houston to recognize him in the story.
So where did you uncover this?
Well, I should have done this in the first place. I looked at the first book of stories she wrote after her time with Houston.
Short story collection.
Yeah, 2 years later. So, you know, she's written dozens and dozens of stories. But, of course, all the stories before she met Houston don't count. So I read this book of stories, and then it jumped out. I mean, it's just obvious who the Houston character is. So then I wrote an article about that. I can't even remember where I published it, or maybe it's still in press. But anyway,
how does she portray Houston as a character?
Well, she portrayed him as a kind of, dashing, romantic, irresistible, handsome, but kind of cold and cruel and manipulative.
Uh-huh.
You know, in other
That's
words,
pretty
she
accurate.
Was, I think she was kind of taken by him, and went to bed with him eagerly and willingly. And then afterwards she said, I don't really like this guy. I'm not sorry I went to bed with him, but he's really not a nice person. And most people in their life, you're delighted to go to bed with somebody they're attracted to, even if they don't particularly like them as a person, just, for the sexual encounter. Not anybody you'd really want to get deeply emotionally involved with, because probably he'd hurt you, as Houston hurt Edna O'Brien in some way that's obliquely suggested in the story.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's many of the women that you write about who keep coming back. They really want to stay with Houston. They don't want to be married to him, but they certainly wouldn't mind spending a weekend with him.
The woman who was most negative was Eloise Hart,
right.
the half Cherokee Indian, half German immigrant parents, she was the one who kept coming in and out of Houston's life. And she was very hard on him. But in the end, when the marriage to Cece broke up, then he would go over to Eloise's house when she was married. I don't know how many husbands she had, I don't know. He said, "Oh God, I like the way you're married. I just like coming in here and playing poker with you guys, and having scrambled eggs at 12 o'clock at night." And Maricela would be sitting in the car just waiting for him for 6 or 8 hours on end.
Yeah.
She would never be brought in. She didn't want to be brought in. Now, here's where the computer comes in. I don't use computer for research. I think taking information off the computer is really a waste of time, because anybody can find that. And a lot of the times it's not reliable.
Mm-hmm.
But what the computer is really good at is checking facts and finding people.
Ah.
It's much more easy to find people now that we have all these address search things. I've never paid money for it. Maybe if I had a really crucial person, I'd pay $13 to get his address.
Maybe we could find the Mexican housekeeper then.
No, because her name is Hernandez, and you've got about 8 million people called Hernandez in Los Angeles. What you really want is somebody with a really strange name where you can find him immediately. But I was trying to find the wife of Billy Pearson, the jockey who was Houston's friend.
And also the one who dabbled in illegal art.
But would you believe, somebody told me that whatever her name was, Dorothy, I can't remember, Pearson, was living in Washington State. Would you believe there were 8 people called Dorothy Pearson in Washington State?
I would imagine.
I mean, no, I just wouldn't.
It's not
that
uncommon a name.
But let me go back to Hemingway, Hemingway book in 1985. I was trying to find a mistress called Jane Mason who was not in previous books on Hemingway, who was tremendously important for his life in the 30s when he was living in Key West. She was unbelievably beautiful, like as beautiful as Grace Kelly, only a little more athletic looking. So she used to be married to, I think it was Arnold Gingrich, who was the editor of Esquire.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was married to somebody called Mason. So somebody said, she's in New Jersey. Jane Mason, that's a tough one in New Jersey, Anyway, I found something like 25 Jane Masons, and I called every single one of them. This is really important, much more important than Billy Pearson's fifth wife.
Right.
And eventually, I can't remember the details, but I found her. She was dead, but I found her son, and I found her granddaughter, and they were living in Tuxedo Park, New York, and they invited me up for the weekend. And they had not only Jane's diary of all the engagements with Ernest when her husband was abroad, away from Cuba on airline business, but home videos on the
really?
Pilar in the 30s.
Wow.
So that was a stupendous discovery. And it was really worth calling 25 people. Also, phone calls are cheap now. They used to be much more expensive.
Right.
You can talk to London for half an hour for about $3 or $4. It's a hell of a lot cheaper than flying over there and all the rest of it. So we started off this discussion the last phase of the discussion about sources of information. Mm-hmm. And, of course, a lot of film books don't even list what the sources are, or else just say, for chapter three, I use John's book and Sam's book. Yeah. And, you know, that doesn't tell you anything. But, you know, I was trained as a scholar. I have a PhD, you know, and I feel if the book has any value, it has to – the sources have to be documented and people can check what you've done.
Well, the other thing you do is you'll make a statement like such and such – it's obvious such and such happened, or it's obvious that, you know, such, you know, that so and so really likes somebody. And you've got to I think you have to document that kind of a thing, or it puts you at risk for being superfluous.
Yeah, they can check anything. And that's the value of the book. I mean, people are going to come behind you using your work. In fact, now many of my biographies are used to make other people's novels, which I think is a bit of a fraudulent enterprise because it's neither original work on their side. Or is it
so they put the character in a setting and use your information?
Yeah.
To
and I find it very
scenes.
Annoying. You know, they acknowledge my book.
Right.
But they also feel they have the right to use anything in it, even though it's not their material. And they'll say, oh, well, you know, everybody knows about Hemingway. You know, so now there's Hemingway's suitcase, Hemingway's chair, Hemingway's boat, Hemingway's this, Hemingway's that. And I'm in every one of those ones. I'm not the only source, but I'm an important source that's named. At least they name it. Sometimes they try to get away without naming it, and then you can nail them on that for plagiarism.
Right.
So that's the Herrick, the people who knew everybody who knew Houston that I could find, and
you used several autobiographies or one or two which have not been published. How did you come across them?
I'm not sure which ones, but I'll give you an example of unpublished material. Somebody told me a guy called Tony Tracy or Terry Tracy had a conference a couple of years ago in Galway, Ireland, on Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And as usual, these books take 4 years to do, you know. So it was still in press, but it was finished. And he had an interview with Angelica. And here again,
that's Houston's daughter. Not everybody knows that.
Yeah, Angelica is John's daughter, and you know the actress.
Right.
And she was in Pritzi's Honor, and she was in The Dead. And she was also in an early film when she was a teenager of his called A Walk with Love and Death, which was a disaster from every possible point of view between father and daughter. And also the film was a disaster about lovers in the Middle Ages. The whole thing was ridiculous. And it wasn't his kind of material. So I write to Tony Tracy, and I said, you know, could I have a look at this Angelica interview? And he, you know, most people would say, wait till the book comes out, but then it would be too late for me.
Sure.
So he sent it to me. I mean, he's really very kind. I thank him for that and the acknowledgments. And it was a very good interview. There was really great stuff in there. And then I must say, contradict myself slightly about use of computer material. If you punch in Angelica, you find about three or four quite nice interviews right on the computer, free of charge,
mm-hmm.
that she gave. And, of course, there's very, very interesting stuff there. Now, a lot of people ask me, what about Angelica? You know, what about Angelica? You know, they all want to know about her. Well, I was warned before I started that Angelica had mercilessly teased Grobel, never said no, never said yes, and never saw him. So I thought, I'm not going to get myself into that, but I have to try to see her. Got in touch with her. Her assistant answered faithfully and never said yes, never said no. You know, in other words, she's just wasting my time. I don't know why. She just didn't say no and forget it.
Right.
But until she said no, I felt I should still. It's like playing a trout on a line. You kind of reel her in. So my last night at the Herrick, my last night in L.A., she was in town. I was in town. I said, this is it. You know, I can see her tonight or tomorrow, or else I'm going back to Berkeley and writing my book. And she didn't want to do it. So there's ways around that. There's the stuff that Tony Tracy gave me, or Terry Tracy. There's the interviews I found. And then lots of people talked about John and Angelica, obviously. But I wasn't interested in Angelica entirely for herself. Angelica had two other things that interested me. One, she had works of art that John had done, John's paintings. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to go to her house and see those paintings.
You describe one painting of her, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. She owns that. I'd like to see that painting. The other thing that interested me a lot is that she lived with Jack Nicholson for 17 years. So I thought if I'd gone on with Angelica, she'd introduce me to Nicholson and then I could have a
including the time that they were doing Chinatown, and there's that great line about sleeping with my daughter.
Yeah.
Yes.
that's, and I wanted to talk to him about Chinatown. I wanted to talk to him about Pritzi's Honor because I think he's, you know, he's the greatest American actor for me. And, you know, he seems like a very interesting guy. So somebody gave me his telephone number at home. So I waited till about 11 o'clock on a Sunday night, hoping that he would be drunk or stoned or something like that. And maybe, you know, just maybe he'd be in the mood. So I called him up. And, you know, a woman answered, an older woman. She said, "Who's calling?" And gave my name, which meant nothing to him. So he wouldn't come to the phone. And then about a couple of weeks later, an English family came to stay with me. And there was a little boy, a very sophisticated, clever little English boy, about 10 years old, who really knew an amazing amount about movies. So I was telling this story. I said, "I have Jack Nicholson's telephone number." And little Nico said, "Give me the phone number. I'll call him. I'll get him to talk to you."
On a final note, what advice can you give our listeners about the writing process, which you have obviously mastered so well?
They like to hang the word prolific around my neck.
Because they can't
conceive of anybody who works so hard and so efficiently and who enjoys the work so much as I do. I'd much rather be working than not working. I'd rather be writing than not writing.
Uh-huh.
When I'm in bed, when I'm sleeping, when I'm dreaming, when I'm walking, even when I'm playing tennis, I'm still thinking about the stuff I'm writing. I just can't get away from it. And I must say that after all these years and all these books and all these articles, I now write more fluently than I ever did. I think more amusingly. I have a good narrative pace. And I think some of the enjoyment and the excitement comes through in the book.
Just the creativity of doing it. Well, Jeffrey Myers, the book is John Huston, Courage and Art. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you.
Next, we hear from novelist and our contributing book critic, Barbara Quick.
What a joy to find a work of fiction as beautifully luminous and utterly engaging as Jean Thompson's new novel, The Year We Left Home. The story of one Iowa family, this novel left me agog with admiration for Miss Thompson's mastery of the craft of writing. And yet her craft is never showy or facile. This is a storyteller who gets inside each of her many characters, pulling the reader into a world that seems just as mysterious and compelling as life itself. Starting in 1973 and ending 30 years later, The Year We Left Home shines a magic light through the tangled threads of shared memories, hopes, and fears that bind a family together through time. I read the book cover to cover on a transatlantic flight, feeling at the end that I could happily read the whole book over again. It would be akin to the pleasure of looking at the childhood photos of people I know and care about. How wonderfully Miss Thompson renders the nuanced volleys of family relationships in which someone wins and everyone loses. Like a modern-day Jane Austen, Jean Thompson uses humor to deflate and ultimately endear even the book's most pompous and wrong-headed characters. We end up feeling empathy for the lot of them. She writes at one point, "You had to love your family. You didn't have any choice in it." The Year We Left Home evokes all the difficulty of returning to the house where your childhood fingerprints are preserved. No matter how far away you travel or how strenuously you redefine yourself, you carry your beginnings right through to the end of your life. The most courageous and enlightened are the ones who manage to spin the sticky webs of it, as Jean Thompson has done in her novel, into gold.
You have been listening to Word by Word, the Conversations with Writers show on KRCB 91.1 FM or streaming online at krcb.org. Tonight's guest was the award-winning biographer Jeffrey Myers, talking about all of the fabulous films, adventurous men, and beautiful women who travel through the pages of his latest book, John Huston, Courage and Art. The studio engineer for tonight's show is Mark Fuller, and I am your host, Gil Manser. We want to invite you to tune in at 7 o'clock Wednesday, November 2nd, for our November word-by-word conversation. Until then, I hope you enjoy the fall colors and get more treats than tricks on Halloween.